Yeah, so I fleet put it on so like this one.
So are you with us?
Yeah, but it's so hot. This one's gonna talk about how like you have it. Eventually, like the fat reserve.
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? How's everybody?
Of that mic to like I
okay.
are uncertain.
How was Christmas?
Concept just
Yeah.
similar, you know, like the explicit in
Yeah,
place. I saw you
I wanted
after
to say when I
Christmas.
said never
Oh,
seen
right.
you before,
Yeah.
but
Yeah.
that's a weird way to phrase it, but like events that you didn't really expect or like are not examples
Yeah,
of. And
last
I guess
week
I
with
didn't
them.
want to
And
be
then,
perfect.
secondly, like, first moment versus second moment,
It's
there's like how that derived them, it seems. Like, how that compares to back and forth, for example. How that predicts, like, meaningful economic activities, for example.
Yeah, in class
So,
with us.
basically, just like how people have done
This
this
week's
kind of thing,
reading. The last
using our
week,
output, we use
we
our
did the
input.
whole technical neural networks class in one day. Covered all of neural networks from what's a neuron to modern transformer LLMs. One day, right? So today, I think we're going to talk about the entire debate about computational models of concepts all in one day. Also, it could be a whole class, so it could be a whole, you know, semester course, a whole year course. So we'll try to cover it all in one day. So we'll see. But I think it's relevant to a bunch of your research. But it's going to be faster than one day because the things to cover besides that. So we'll see. Hi, Runa.
So, now you haven't modified the notebook, right?
I modified it like for the puns case,
Okay, did you push the
but
modification?
I gave it to Nikhil to like
Oh, you're pushing it. Oh, okay.
and the thing is that the pun stuff doesn't work programmatically. Like
Of
Jane and
course.
I were trying to
It's
figure it
not
out. There's
a.
some discrepancy between what Neuronpedia does and what's happening
Perfect.
programmatically, even on the default model without steering.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
it's an opportunity.
Such a research topic,
Yeah.
like these discrepancies. I think, you know, we, you know, so there's actually, I'm serious. So, Adam on the end of here is interested in putting together some sort of research paper on these discrepancies,
Yeah.
and.
Yeah, Jane was thinking of it because like they use transformer lens and there's some potential like yeah.
Yeah, what are the differences? Nobody's doing anything fancy. It's just like, yeah. So, who was here for Cheng Fan's? Is it she thing? Maybe nobody. Okay, in our lab
That was
meeting.
virtual.
Yeah. But it's actually kind of like, where, you know, I don't think they're doing anything different to these models, but they behave differently at times. What's going on? Yeah. So when do we start? Do we start now? Okay, let's start now. We'll start a little a minute early instead of 5 minutes late because we have too much to cover. All right. So who's team S? Spatial team. Okay. Are you guys ready to present?
I don't think I'll just talk to you. Maybe a team will present
Well,
first.
who's
We
team
have
E?
everyone.
Oh, team E is like ready to go. Okay, team S. Okay, so. Let me cover for everybody what we're gonna do today. And as you guys come on, you can come on up. Just
Oh, wait, should I announce?
yeah, you can announce whatever you want to announce. So okay, so first of all, you know, Nikhil is our TA.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. Okay. And so back from India. And what's the announcement? I forgot the
Yeah,
announcement.
I think there's a few logistical things. If anyone has any enrollment issue, please as soon as possible
Oh yeah,
because
because it's like.
these
It's like the
are
end, like the
last.
registrar won't listen to us in a couple of days.
Yeah.
So, yes, any
Oh,
enrollment issues?
I haven't voted for the course. I'm going to do anything else.
Yeah.
Unless you want it in your transcript, you don't need to do anything.
Okay.
Okay. And what was the second thing?
Come on up.
Let me finish.
You can announce it.
Actually forgot. But one thing was, we have updated the link to our NDI server on the website.
Oh, the Discord server.
Yeah, the Discord server.
Oh, yeah, that invite link wasn't working before.
Yeah. We should use that link to join the Discord server.
Yeah, if you want to talk to people about anything in real time, you can use that.
Yeah.
It's something for the class. It's optional. Okay. Okay, before we do this, so today's plan is lots to do. We're going to have Team S and Team E. Team E first, present the project pitches, about 5 to 10 minutes each. And then I'll give a very brief, because we're doing this at the same time as project pitches, I'll do a very brief structuring discussion about the mission to everybody. I'm going to try to pack an entire year course into this 1.5 hour lecture. So we'll do it interactively so that we can kind of see where everybody is. And we'll do this discussion. And I'll mostly point you to more readings. And then we have a notebook on steering at the Aruna prepared. And so Aruna will step us through this. So those 3 things, about 1/2 hour each. Okay, Amy, go ahead. So go ahead and plug in your HDMI. And then you can click over that button way in the corner. If you click on that touch screen, click that one. And then, okay, there you are. And then when we're done, the other team S can plug in. So go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Working E for excellent in economics.
Excellent.
And economics. And we're thinking of working on economic uncertainty and LMs using earnings calls. And I'm Veronica. I'm a third year PhD student in economics at Boston University.
I'm Veronica, first year PhD student at Northeastern. So expectations are key to economics. If a firm has expectations that the economy is going to do well, they're going to hire more people, which improves the amount of spendable income in the economy, which in turn improves the economy and improves expectations that things are going to do well. So there's this virtuous cycle that as long as everyone is believing everything is good, everything will stay good. But uncertainty kind of breaks that cycle. So uncertainty, like tariffs, Brexit, trade policy disputes, all this stuff can break up the economy, as you can see in these headlines here.
And in the market today, it's really interesting.
Yeah. And do economists care about uncertainty? Yes, they write about it in like 45% of their papers. So it's most obvious that they do care about uncertainty.
But since we're economists and we like to measure everything with numbers, we're going to use a definition of uncertainty that's regarding the moments of a statistical distribution. Usually, you think about it in like the terms of returns to stocks, for example. So usually we think about uncertainty in the terms of moments. So the first moment that we're going to study is the sentiment. For example, you can see firms are happy or sad. And then a second moment that you're going to study is whether firms are thinking that things are going to be uncertain. This is like volatility measure. And using examples from earnings calls, for example, we can see changes in sentiments and changes in, this is supposed to say uncertainty. For example, this is Nucor Corporation, and they have this expected decrease because of their seasonal effects. And this is something that they probably face every year, so it's not really uncertain it's going to happen. And then this is Apple in their second quarter of last year. They said that they didn't really have a lot of tariff impact in the first quarter, in the March quarter, but for June, they really weren't sure on how tariffs were going to impact their outcome. So this is clearly some uncertainty regarding tariffs, and this is just some feeling of like things are not going that well. So these are two different things that we're trying to distinguish. And how do we measure this? So there is a lot of literature trying to measure uncertainty using text. They use like newspapers, Twitter, like reports, earnings calls, and we have a slide on why earnings calls, but I don't have time. And the idea is that you can make a dictionary of words that you consider are related to risk. So uncertain, risk, unsure, things like that. And then you can measure how many words regarding uncertainty show up in a sentence. So that's usually how people have measured uncertainty so far. And there's this Brexit paper, which is really good for us because they separate the idea of the Brexit sentiment and the Brexit uncertainty, and they really use that to measure uncertainty in like all of Europe, basically. And economists have really quickly taken on LLMs to do different things. And there's this big paper now that is measuring geopolitical risk. And in this, they use the LLM, they provide all the entire earnings call, which are very long, and they provide definitions and concepts about like, this is what you consider to be a tariff. This is a tariff, this is a boycott, this is a sanction. And then you identify where those things show up in the earnings calls and firms are talking about it. That's the idea. And they just like measure what your political risk is. And there's this other paper that uses specific definitions of uncertainty. And then something that we do in economics is that we need numbers. So what they use is like they feed in this idea, what, and they ask, is this economic policy uncertainty? And then they ask GPT or like any other LLM to provide a measure. So from 0 to 1, how much uncertain is this? Like, that's sort of like the idea behind this paper. So to summarize a little bit about LLM's work in economics, people usually have this concept that they want to define. So think about it like industrial policy uncertainty, the meaning of life. Someone studied the meaning of life. I don't know, that's econ, but that's the paper. And then we want to use the LLM to classify a certain data set using that definition. Sometimes people manually have a golden data set, but recently people have just been like using like bigger LLMs to annotate one data set and then expanding. There's also some cases in which people just ask, is this uncertainty, without providing a definition? And then optionally, we want to create measures from like 0 to 1 or like from 0 to 100 of how much uncertainty or whatever that is. And then we want to use that to predict. So for example, to predict returns to stocks and stuff like that. And there is some literature on that. You want to talk about this one?
Sure. In terms of like how like of the use of LLMs in economic, where they kind of examine the internals, there's like this one paper where they study how LLM process financial information by scanning internal states. So they basically use SAEs to like decompose like the latent activations, and then they sort of extract this one particular feature that represents risk. And so they also try to like steer this risk feature such that like it sort of like positively correlates to with the model's output of like risk tolerance. So for example, they might prompt the model, help me like allocate this asset between S&P 500 and some more risky bonds. But when we steer this like risk feature, the model should be like more or less risky. So I guess building upon all of those, we propose 3 research questions. They sort of like build on top of each other. The first one, we do want to understand like how LLMs interpret uncertainty internally. So because a lot of previous methods in economics use like bag of words, those traditional techniques, we sort of want to know like if LLMs go beyond those simple techniques. So for example, those techniques might use like direct mentions of uncertainty, then can we like sort of, for example, examine if LLMs also activate on those non-direct mentions, but those that imply uncertainty, for example, the investigation on the head of Federal Reserve, which we know that it seems uncertain, but like do LLMs, well, bad words definitely won't work on that instance, but like do LLMs work on that instance? So some techniques we are thinking of are include like activation patching or SAEs. For example, you could extract an SAE feature and examine whether it activates on both direct and indirect mentions of uncertainty. Going beyond that, we mentioned how people distinguish between the first and second moment. So we want to know if LLMs also learn this kind of distinction. So previously, the bag of words model, they extract mentions of
positive sentiment to represent the first moment. They extract the mentions of risk-related synonyms to represent the second moment, but we want to see if LLMs internally represent or like distinguish those two concepts. And lastly, previous studies, just like we talked about, have used LLMs to derive the economic policy indices. So like, economic policy uncertainty. So as a measure of how uncertain the historic tax is, but can we like develop reliable measures of this uncertainty from its internal representation? And for example, those studies have shown that these indices correlate with some interesting economic activities, like how people invest, etc. So can we, like, for example, directly prompt the model to predict the economic activities and then examine its internals and extract that uncertainty measure so that, and to see like if those uncertainty measures correlate with the economic or like financial market activities. And also we could even manipulate or like steer those representations to see if those uncertainty measures causally affect the predictions on economic markets.
Hey, this is Natalia Shapira. Can I interrupt with a question?
Yeah, we're done. I don't know where to go.
Okay. Can you give a concrete examples of uncertainty in text as opposed to text that are clear without uncertainty?
Can you go to the second or third sports slide, the one that has example?
Yes, sorry, I was in 5 minutes late, so I might need
to. It's okay. Yeah, I don't know where to look, but we have this example, and this should say uncertainty in the second example.
Okay, thanks.
Where's the camera?
The camera is right here, so she can see you. Yeah.
I didn't know what to
look. Thanks, thanks. I can see you.
More questions?
I just have a comment. There's another paper which tried to understand uncertainty neurons. I think it was last year.
What?
Uncertainty neurons.
In what?
In what? In just language model.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't really specific to economics per se in any sense. They were just trying to understand how this uncertainty is represented inside the model. Might be relevant.
Can you share with me?
So related to that, I would be, you know, very interested because the topic of studying an AI's uncertainty about its own internal reasoning is sort of a very machine learning concept. A lot of machine learning people are interested in how uncertain AIs are about their own internal reasoning. Probably the paper that Nikhil is going to share with you is about that. But you're studying how it understands uncertainty in like a third person piece of text. And I'm kind of, you might consider asking the question whether those are the same thing, right? Whether its own internal, if it knows when somebody else is uncertain, it's sort of the same thing as when it's uncertain itself, or if those are completely different thoughts.
Well, something that we thought was, if like internally, what does it mean for it to understand uncertainty? If we don't give it a definition and we ask it, is this firm uncertain about the future trade policy, what does it mean?
Yeah.
And how does it change when we provide a different definition? If it changed at all, because it could not change. That's something we thought, maybe related to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You might be able to, it might be interesting to see if you can parse apart different types of uncertainty that might have different representations. You know, another question is, it might know that the speaker on the earnings call feels a certain level of uncertainty, but it might have its own perception of uncertainty, which is different from what they say. You know, doesn't that happen when somebody on an earnings call says, we're absolutely certain, but then there's some other cues that you might, as a listener, pick up and say, you know what, I don't think it's very certain. And so it'd be interesting also, to, you know, so these are, I think these are beyond your first order things, maybe, the thing to look at first, right? But I think these are reasonable things to keep a lookout for.
Like, I remember there's something, I don't remember what government agency did it, but they tried to map, like, when people say probably or certainly, like, what actual likelihoods are do people mean when they say words like that, and seeing like how calibrated is the LLMs. Like you could try to map it to, or is it encoding like what humans tend to, the distribution of meanings that people, like when people say it's like certainly going to happen, so people mean like 99.999% chance, but other people mean 80% chance or something. So
it could be interesting if.
One more question. So I'm thinking down the finer thing. So how feasible is this? So do you have data sets and so on that you use to power this thing?
My boss wrote the, so my PI is the guy from the other one, the Brexit paper. So he wrote like a bunch of papers on using earnings calls and using these dictionary methods. So I do have the earnings calls and the measures that he builds we can use.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because it's like it's a very easy formula, it's like an index.
Yeah, very, that's fantastic. Nice baseline.
Yeah, so we chose this.
Okay, Team S. Team S.
Thank you.
So, yeah, somebody needs HTML and plug it into that thing. You guys have HDMI?
Oh,
yeah, somebody does. Okay, great.
There's a chair here.
Oh, there's another chair. Somebody, hey, who's next? Olivia, Arnav. Take a seat.
There's another chair available here.
Oh, yeah. What's yours? Hey, take a seat, Michael.
Be away.
Yeah. Is it visible?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Elevator pitch. I don't know. There's too many people for an elevator. Okay.
Hello everyone, we're group S and our topic is spatial and perceptual reasoning. And my name is Yuqi, and I'm currently a CS master's student. And this is my last semester here.
How you have PhD student in civil engineering?
It's oh, I'm a master's student too.
Okay, so when we talk about spatial reasoning, we always think about object level relationship. So for example, if in the first image, we may ask, where is the pizza? Is it on the edge of the dining table? And for this kind of question, we always talk about the object relationship in the image. However, there is another kind of question that we may ask in our real life, for example, in this image, is it a place, is it place looks safe? This question is the scene level perception that we still don't know that does vision language model understand the concept of safe from the image and how it understands it. So our research is mainly motivated by this kind of question, and we want to explore does vision language model understand the concept of safe and how it may judge the judgment based on the image we give. And there are still some potential sub-question we want to explore. Which region or visual cue in the image is more important for the vision language model to make the judgment? And how the judgment emerge and differentiate in different layers? And how the reasoning process align with humans' reasoning process?
Okay, so our motivation is we want to understand how the real end works. We want to like look into how the visual concepts are encoded in the real end. And the second motivation would be like what the models output for scene level perception is similar to humans' perception, or we want to like make it better to match more with humans' perception. And the third reason would be like we can actually use that for embodied household agents or like auto autonomous drivings and things like that in the real world. And this is also beyond the object centric LLMs where we currently have.
Yeah, there's some well established literature review on the how previous work. He said there's some existing work on object level specialization, which is described before, such as VSR, and it evaluates the pairwise objective relationship and some other VLMs. And there are previous studies revealed that there's some monosemantic features in the language models, and we have some object level visual representation from contrast theory, like club. And there are some gaps that how does VLM encode holistic on scene level concepts, and that's the integration across the entire environments, and does it show the mechanistic representation beyond the object level regions? Yeah, so, and there's some scene level spatial condition theory that is outside of computer science, such as Kaplan defined a preference matrix about the urban environment in four dimensions, such as coherence, complexity, legibility, mystery, and some other authors like Lynch. They described the image theory, how to the imaginability of the scene in five different spatial elements, and also in the urban planning, there's a theory about how does the people feel about the environment.
Okay, so move on to the data set. We have the MIT Placemas 2.0, which have the six special dimensions for human data on each scene. And they for each picture they have the score of safety, beauty, liveliness, wealthy, wealth, boringness, and depressiveness. And I'll move on to the next. It says we have cityscapes and wastes, and these two datasets are for segmentations, and we also want to use these for segmentations to see like whether we remove some parts of the picture, what would that affect the model's output, and that would be all for our segmentations. Any questions and queries?
Yes. How do you define safety of this?
It is interesting. So we want to like see how actually VLMs understand it. So before we actually define it, we want to first look into the VLMs first.
In some data sets, they have a human rated score of how safe this place is from 1 to 10.
How did they like define it? What are the like factors within safety? Like I could imagine that it being like a place, and then is it like crime statistics, or is it like a classroom that's like a safe space?
Okay, that's just based on image.
Yeah, any other queries? Yes.
Yeah, I think this is super fascinating. There's like a long-standing debate within the world of policing around this thing called broken windows theory that
emerged
in the 80s. And so like when you're talking about this, I'm thinking very much about that. And like the basic idea there was that like things like broken windows signal the place is unsafe, people don't care about it. If you fix the windows, you'll fix the serious stuff. There's been a lot of research since then that suggests that that kind of perception of safety is completely divorced from the actual safety of a place, and that people's perceptions of safety tend to map on more to things like racial composition of the neighborhood. How good are the schools? How nice are the cars? And these sorts of things that end up being pretty orthogonal to the question of kind of safety in a physical sense. So I just wanted to like flag that for you all. I think it'd be super interesting if you actually found that the LLM was encoding that perception of human safety, but that also might have some within the kind of like finer framework implications on the ethics sides of things.
If you have any, you know, articles or something about broken windows theory or any of the things, put it for us to the team or to the Discord. That'd be really helpful, I think.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Go ahead.
And, kind of going off of what you just said, I was thinking it's more from like also a perspective of who the individual is, because one individual might find a scene safe while another might not, depending on their background and experiences, right? And so I do wonder, like, how can the LLM evolve towards one certain type of food, for example, and how it chooses to portray something or label something.
Right. That's a good question. Yeah.
So you guys are getting a sense for the I and finer, right? Which is like what people would be interested in, which is, you know, so I would like sort of take a note of this, right? I think a lot of traditional computer vision research in the last 10 years would have taken a look at something like this and said, is my model capable of matching my labels and my data set of whether something's safe or not? But I think that we're beyond that. I think the models are capable of matching labels in the data set. And now the question is, where does this inference come from? How accurate is it? How many different personas can you take on? And where did it learn it from? So you have this interesting VLM. It learned from vision. It learned from language. I don't know if it's going to be possible, but it seems like an interesting question. If it has some idea that this is safe or unsafe, did it learn that from reading some text somewhere? Or did it learn it from, you know, its visual, you know, pathway? Is that like a piece of textual knowledge? If it's textual, does it have different concepts of safety, like, you know, people are talking about here? You know, maybe stored in different ways, or if you give it a different persona, you know, it might perceive something differently, and can you find how that's represented or processed inside? I think these are sort of the questions that would differentiate you from if you had done this project 5 years ago. That makes sense. Any other suggestions, any questions?
You can add on that, because there's an Anthropic paper that was recently published, which was studying personas and language models. And so it sounded, what you were saying, David, was quite similar to what they were doing on a strictly language basis and more focused on the actual like persona rather than quality of the scene. So yeah, I could maybe share that paper in the Discord for context if there's a topic. It seemed like a place to start from if that specific topic for something.
It's often easier to do research where you compare two things rather than just look at one thing. So if you look at one thing, it's like, oh, a bunch of your research questions were phrased as, does my model do this? Can it do this? Whatever, right? But it can be hard to analyze, because if you sort of publish a thing saying, oh yeah, we think it did it, it could do it 27%, that means it did it. Some other people will look at it and say, well, 27% means it can't do it. So, you know, what's your conclusion? But if you compare two things, it's a lot easier to say, ah, it does more of this in this situation, less of this in this other situation. If we train it as a reasoning model, it does more of this. If we don't train it as a reasoning model, it does more of this. If we tell it it has this persona, it does more of this. If we tell it has that persona, this. So it like that could be easier to come up with an interesting conclusion.
I mean, one point on that is so I think somebody mentioned from behind that humans have different perception of safety.
Mm-hmm.
It might be the case that models also have different perceptions of reality. I mean, if you use your data set on different types of models, let's say models from American companies versus Chinese companies, they might have different behavior on that data set. Maybe you can use that, I mean, these two models for comparison and maybe study analysis.
Some technical suggestions and advice. So with VLMs, at least till last year, before Qwen VLMs came out, the long-running consensus is that when it comes to preference, VLMs heavily prefer their language side than the visual side of things. For instance, even if you show the picture of Northeastern University, but you caption it by saying it has broken windows, let's say, most of the time the language, the VLM would say, yeah, it's unsafe. Right. So I think this was not done on the latest models, and it's seen that these new models are much more capable. I think it would be interesting if you can somehow try to figure out if it comes from the text side of things or the image side of things. And there are like some good baselines you can think of, right? One is you don't caption the image and just ask the question, is it safe? And then you don't provide any image, but just caption it somehow, like provide a black image and caption it. And see how it performs. It would be a good baseline, I think, for you to think where this is. And second one is, again, when it comes to preference, people found it easier if you gave a VLM two images and asked them to compare them so that it's easier to look at the attention patterns and see what it is they're looking at when they're comparing two images. I think it would also be an interesting setup if you end up not finding the single image setup very fruitful.
You might want to ask Rohit for more advice as you go through the project. He's sort of our most vision expert person in the lab.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
Any other questions or suggestions for the project? If not, then thank you very much.
That's it. All right, guys. So, all right, how are we doing on time? Are we half an hour in now? What are we in? 20 minutes? Oh, not too bad. We're going through so fast. All right, lots to do. Good. Okay. The research skills. Nice work. So, I think that, so, you remember on the recent project, I think that we started off with the eye, just like polling our classmates, giving a pitch, trying to get a sense for what other researchers would be interested in. We have no idea if any of these ideas are feasible. They're all, I'll tell you, like every single one of the proposals right now is too broad. There's no way you can answer all the questions that any of you presented. You can end up with something much more narrow. So the next step is for you to start getting an intuition about what's feasible, the F in fine art. So the assignment for Thursday is to try using some technical methods. We have these exploratory methods that we're going to look at. We have logit lens. Arun will show you Neuronpedia. You can, if you know other methods or other things, you can try other things, but you've got at least two exploratory research methods for, putting some text or putting some input into a model and trying to see what insights or what intuition you can kind of get out. None of them are rock solid, complete experimental methods, but they're experimental, exploratory things that you can use to get a little intuition. And so on Thursday, your team's job will be to put together your 5 or 10 minutes of experimental results from your explorations to try to suggest what part of your research question you think is the feasible one or the feasible set that you're going to pursue or not. Or if you have a negative result and you say, well, we looked at everything's a mess, then just share that with us as well. That make sense? Okay, so that's for Thursday, you guys. So probably some of you have already been doing that because you know it's coming, but I just want to remind you. All right, so the lecture part. So there were a few readings. I don't know if you all read all three of the things. Some people read some of them at least enough to submit a question. That's nice. So we're going to try and do the same thing. And I have the challenge here. So what this reading was about this week was about two things. One is I want to catch everybody up with this notion that concepts are vectors, that we are trying to understand the power of the representations in this neurovector space, which is how a certain school of a certain community of neural network people have been thinking about concept representations, you know, certainly for the last few years, but actually for decades. But that comes in a larger context, a larger historical context that I wanted you to get a little flavor of. But covering the larger historical context is sort of a whole semester course. So I didn't give you guys like 10 papers to read, but I'm going to try to give you a little sense for it now. So there's a central question: what is that concept? And actually, who's Isaac? Isaac, you asked this in your question, like, right? What was your question?
Yeah,
you kick us off.
Sure. So all of the papers are talking about concepts.
Yeah.
Like distinguishing concepts from language.
Yeah.
But they're not necessarily formally defining.
They're not defining it.
And so it seemed like each of the three readings may have a slightly different idea of what a concept
people
is.
People just flinging around this word, concept. Seems pretty loaded. Yeah. And what do you think that is going on there? Why do you think people are not seeing down that? It's just being sloppy here.
I'm not totally sure.
Yeah. I think partially it's they're being sloppy. I think partially that they also know that there's this historical baggage around it. And it's like, well, this is not the place to get into it. You know, choose your own definition, right? Because it can be quite involved. And so, Christopher asks a question that I like. So Christopher, go ahead. Yeah, what was your question?
Well, so my question here is, what I felt dark with in the paper was like, you know, here's a lot of theories and a lot of grounds that's like, you know, here's circumstantial reasons for why it's plausible, why it's convenient, why it's beneficial to adopt the representation, but they don't offer a falsifiable statement saying, well, if we're wrong, this is how we'll know.
What, like, there's something missing in this Piantedosi reading that I gave you. And so what's missing is he's not sticking up for his intellectual opponents, right? He's like, this is my view. And you know, I think I'm right. And when you read it, because I just gave you this paper in isolation, you're like, okay, well, that seems fine. But what would it mean if he was wrong? Like, how's that even falsifiable? So let me give you that context here. So let's do that. So this is him. So here's like the world that he lives in. So the classical name for this is connectionism. Who's heard the term connectionism? Okay, so connectionism is a term that the neural networks people made up for themselves. That's what they called themselves in the 80s. They're connectionists. And so there's his name. Hinton won the Nobel Prize. He was a student of Roma Hart, and you know, there's McClelland, sort of pioneer neuroscientists. There's a guy, Smolensky, who I recommend reading. I think that, did you say that you met Smolensky?
Yeah.
He's still active research today at MSR. That really interesting work by Smolensky. You read the Piantedosi paper, but basically these are folks who think that concepts are vectors. That basically what a concept is of course it's there's different perspectives on what a concept is. I'll come to the next slide. But then the most useful way of thinking about a concept is how it's represented in a neural network as like a vector representation. And they ask, how do you understand how concepts relate to each other in terms of the geometry of vectors? The linear algebra of vectors, other things that you do with vectors, distances, angles, right? And but they're not alone. So you read the Piantedosi paper, and he says, "Yeah, concepts are vectors." So there it is. So there's a couple other intellectual schools of thought here, like the right way of thinking about the computation of concepts. And so, so there's the symbolic AI people, the symbolic, the symbolists, right? So who's heard of Noam Chomsky? Yeah, he's the man, right? And then there's Minsky and Chomsky, and there's a bunch of other people. Fodor is actually waded into this debate and has some really interesting readings that I put in the supplemental readings that are there. And so what they would say a concept is more of a classical view. Like a concept is like something that you could write a sentence about, like a dictionary definition. A concept is like a set of rules. It's like a set of, you know, a concept comes from like what you can define it to be. Like if you asked a lawyer, what is a concept? They might like say, okay, well, it's this, but there's some caveats, and the more you write, the more you can pin down the concept. And you know, a lawyer might be able to give you like a long paragraph about a concept and really, really pin it down. And they're like, yeah, that's the exercise we go through when we're really trying to understand a concept, because we are coming up. And so, and if you want to understand it computationally, they think a lot about language. That's why the Chomsky thing is so important. Like, how do you express, like, John loves Mary. That's a nice concept, right? And you can express this concept as a relationship between a couple things as a sentence, and you could add more adjectives or more sentences to that to refine the concept. So that's sort of the idea, and it's very, very compositional. This the way that symbolic people think about concepts, and it also relates to the way that we program all of our computers today. Whenever you write an if statement, and you have an if this and that or that, and you have all these conjunctions and your predicates, and you string together all this logic, it's all from the symbolic tradition. Like all of the by hand, you know, computing things that we do are models of symbolic concepts. Right? Make sense? And then there's a third school that's a little bit more modern. And so it comes from, in the 90s, people started to say, these guys are too abstract, right? Like, we're just, like, what makes us, you know, focus on these computational things? We're just biological creatures. We live in the world. We perceive things. You know, the things that, like, all of the things that we think and perceive and understand as concepts are just side effects of like, our life in the world. And the way that, you know, when I touch this thing and I feel it and see it, I interact with it, this eraser thing, then my concept of the thing derives from this embodied experience that I have. And so there's this embodied school of thought that says that has this other perspective on what a concept is. Yes.
I feel a little bit naive that maybe people have experienced before, but I don't see where connectionism and the grounded view are
different.
Yeah, can go together.
Yeah, they kind of go together a little bit. They all have relationships to each other. Like nowadays, you know, we have these huge neural networks, and what are our favorite neural networks? They're processing language, right? You know, the neural network people avoided language for a long time, but now like language is the way to do them. So there's a lot of I think there's a lot that has been gained over the decades from these three warring factions battling against each other intellectually, saying, you're missing this, and you can't do this, and your model of thinking doesn't work this way. And they all try to patch up what they're missing, and I think that it's actually advanced the field. And so a lot of the stuff that we do in large-scale AI today is actually motivated by these old debates. You know, like, the huge investment in language, I think, is motivated by a lot of intuition. That yeah, there's a lot of stuff in language you can't get out of a regular neural network unless you take it seriously. And also the huge investment in multimodal AI with vision and other modes comes from this debate with embodied folks that where they say you there's no way you can understand the world unless if you've never seen it, you don't even have eyes. Right?
That makes sense.
And so here's like the debates on my diagram. So I really like this slide. This is an AI-assisted slide, but you know, curated by hand. So you go into the PowerPoint, you can see what I curated. And so between each of these schools, you've got different things. Okay, so yeah, so actually, so Jasmine, what was your question? Where's Jasmine?
Oh, I forgot.
What was it's something about versus symbols or something like that. What was your question?
Oh, I don't
have too many questions.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right. Ask any question you have. Your turn. You don't remember your question?
Okay,
it's all right. I probably have a record if I didn't bring it. And so these are the debates between the neural network connectionist people and the symbolic people. And so these are like, I would say, two primary debates. So the neural network people, they go to the symbolic people and they say, yeah.
I was just gonna ask, like, given that now, you know, we have these language models and things, are the connectionists winning the debate?
I think that's what Piantedosi is saying. He's like victory. Let's publish a paper in PNAS and tell everybody, forget all this stuff. Concepts are vectors. Probably. This is probably right. But you know, we're done here. Is basically what he's saying. And that's what his paper is trying to say. But like I'm trying to put it in a little bit broader context so that you can understand, because there's some of the stuff will actually impact the way you might decide to choose some of your research topics. So let me give you this debate, and then you'll see. So on one side, it's we know we're familiar with the debate. You say, hey, you symbolic people, you can't even make complex systems that deal with ambiguity and gradations of truth and things like that, and you can't even learn, right? I mean, everything you put into a symbolic system, you have to like program by hand and, you know, make long lists and big dictionaries and databases and stuff like that. And well, you look at the whole world of software today, you actually can build a lot of complexity with this whole symbolic approach. But there's a lot of stuff you can't do. All the cool new neural network stuff you can't do with symbolic systems. It has no answer to learning. It has no answer to this sort of approximate reasoning. Pattern matching doesn't do very well. And so that's, we're familiar with that. That's what's driving the stock market higher. Maybe not today, but yeah, that's what's going on. And so what about the other side? So what the symbolic people are still around. You can see them on Twitter. What's the name, right? What's the name of, Gary Marcus, right? Gary Marcus, he's always the reliable defendant for the symbolic people, if you go follow Gary Marcus on Twitter. And this is like, so the strongest argument actually came from Fodor. I put a link to Fodor's old paper where he introduced this argument back in the 1980s. As I just added it just this morning as extra optional reading to week two. And but if you think about how you represent a concept as a vector, then you think about what kind of concepts humans really need to deal with, you end up with this puzzle about compositionality and binding, right? Like, John loves Mary, right? So, okay, we might have a vector for John. We might have a vector for Mary. So what's the vector for, like, John loves Mary? You know, there's a vector for loves. Did you, like, add them together? Maybe you add them together or something like that. Well, if you add them together, then is that the same as Mary loves John? I don't know. I think it might be different. I think John might love Mary without Mary loving John. Maybe Mary really doesn't like John, right? You know, and like, how do you represent that? That makes sense. And so this compositionality, like, how did you just add the vectors together? Like, how the heck does this work? Is a puzzle. If you believe the concepts are vectors, right? And so the symbolic people wrote this long paper in, you know, 1988 or something around how you're never going to do it. You're never going to figure out composition in this vector view of the world. Mic drop. Don't do neural networks, right? Stick with our expert systems and databases, right? And, but then in the years since, the neural network people have been trying to answer that. And, you know, some of our research, like the binding research done by Nikhil, starts to ask, you know, how are these neural networks actually solving this problem? But what happened is, you know, even before Piantedosi, before the LLM era, people were asking this question theoretically. They said, is it even possible for a vector space to represent binding and relationships with a certain amount of power? Now, I'll talk about that in a minute. Right, does that make sense? And then so they had these like abstract theoretical arguments of like how you could do it and how the math would look and how the neurons might hook things together. And now, like, our empirical world since 2017 has caught up and exceeded what the theoreticians have been reasoning about. Clearly our models can do binding, at least to some level. Clearly our models can do a bunch of these compositional things. Yet we actually don't know if the theoreticians were right. If all these like mathematical structures that they proposed, like if you were a neural network, you could do it this way. We don't know if they're actually doing these things, or if they're doing something different.
And so,
it's worth like, you know, if you're kind of curious about rooting your research in some of the old stuff, it's worth reading some of the old things and seeing what people are thinking. Okay, so the debate between the so what's the difference between these guys? Somebody asked that. So, you know, between the neural network people and the binary people, it seems like the same,
right?
So it's a little bit of a funny intellectual idea. But there's this question that psychologists even ask. They said, what if you had been born blind? And maybe even born without a sense of smell or touch or anything, all you could do is process language. And you only knew what people told you about. Then would you be able to understand the world, like a fully, like, you know, if you couldn't move around the world or anything like that, you just heard stories about it, could you actually understand what it meant to have a sunny day, right, to walk to class, you know, to go get a Dunkin' Donuts, whatever, right? Like, could you understand these things? Or is your understanding like meaningless in some algebraic ways? These are just symbols that you're just manipulating, and it's inevitably going to be missing something. And so, the neural network people say, yes, all of knowledge is all relationships. It's all relational. Like grounding is not so important, right? Because it's all about how all the different concepts are related to each other. So there's this wonderful paper by but what's Phil Weisler's lab, the Platonic hypothesis, who's the first author on HUH, right? Jacob Hutt and Philip Weisler, that just came out a year ago. They're firmly in this camp. They said, hey, if you train a model just on vision and you train a model just on language, they like form these internal graphs of like relationships between all their internal concepts. And if you look at the graphs, if you look at this, the kernel, right, so all the dot product relationships, right, they're the same. Even though the vision one has never seen language and the language one has never seen vision, like they have the same model of the world if you train them big enough anyway. And the point here is maybe you don't need grounding, right? You can build a model of the world without ever having seen it, right? But then the embodied people are like, no, you gotta see it. There's things you'll always miss. And so now the neural network people are like, well, okay, sure, that's fine. But like we can just solve this by putting a video camera on our LLM, right? And then now it can see, you know, attaching it to a robot, now it can touch, you know, giving it some problems to solve, now it can plan, that can do all the other things that you experience in real life. And so that's sort of the path that we're going down now, is trying to fill in these gaps. But there are some people who argue that, you know, maybe it's not even so essential, like without, like, you know, it's like maybe easier than we thought because you could learn a lot just from language. Okay, so that's that debate. And then there's also this interesting thing here where people, like, if you say everything's about grounding, then, you know, it's the same argument here. The symbolic people have no grounding. But then the objection from the symbolic people, the grounding people, like, okay, people, grounding people, you think everything is about what you can see and feel and touch and see? Right? What about the concept of seven? Where does seven come from? Have you ever touched seven? And what is that? What about the concept of justice? Right? How does that play into what you can feel and touch and see? Right? So the symbolic people they love these language puzzles, right? And they're like, you're missing this. So that's the three-way debate between these communities. Just a little kind of a, that makes sense? And so we are sitting here, this whole class, you can think of as continuing this tradition. And one way of thinking of it is for 50 years, people have theorized in order to resolve these debates about what can be done here.
But now there's this engineering solution of just making these systems, and they can do all these things. They can do them. But we actually don't know whether the way they're solving them matches up with what the theorist posed. And there's like a 50-year-old history here that's kind of interesting to retrace. It's like, answer. Like, is it working the way we thought, or should we be surprised? Maybe it's like, it's working, but it's working in a totally different way. And so by peering inside the brains and inside the neural networks, you know, you can resolve some of these questions if that interests you. So for the neural network view, I think there's a couple other questions. So let me let Hayu and Kai ask questions as I, and maybe I can use some of the materials here to help out. So Hayu, are you around?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was your question?
I was reading Paul's paper, and I think things like that, the features and the number of neurons has a superposition.
Yeah.
I don't understand how that superposition here tells.
Great. So we'll talk about superposition in a minute, but so one of your questions is like, what is even a feature?
Yeah.
Right? And so a feature is another rough synonym for concept, right? It's just like, it's what machine learning people say when they've got a represented concept and they don't want to wade into the whole debate about what is a concept. So then say, well, what we have is a feature. It's kind of like that. It's a concept, but you don't want to debate about. So there's really three perspectives as a neural network person that you have on any feature or concept that you're looking at, right? One is the primary thing we're studying, which is, oh, there's some neural configuration. You know, you get your neural network in some state. You can put a number on every neuron, right? That's like all the information that's in your neural network, right? Or some subset of the information or something, right? Some subvector, right? So this is like, so one way of thinking of like, what is a feature or a concept is some part of this thing, this big vector that you've got, right? But then there's these other perspectives, right? So, oh yeah, and if you're a neuroscientist, then take the fMRI. That's what you said, right? But then, like, informally, or maybe philosophically, right, that you know, the brain, or maybe the neural network, is sort of thinking a thought. It's thinking something. Right? So you might have, like a concept, like the food that Alice loves, you know? You get your neural network to think about all the food that Alice loves. We're going to get ready to cook some food or order some food for Alice. We've got to know what food Alice loves, right? So that corresponds to some state the neural network is in. But then it might also correspond to, like, just informally, like, oh, yeah, like, all this different food that Alice has, like, the actual concept, right? And then the third thing it corresponds to, and this is the interesting thing, because, like, this is easy for people to understand. You can say, oh, she loves vegetarian food, except nothing with pineapples, please, right? And, you know, you could imagine all the different types of food. Right, but it's kind of like, how do you map between this thing and that thing? How do you like do science on that? It's really kind of intractable. It's like, this is like a fuzzy informal thing, right? And so there's this other perspective that was proposed by like David Marr and other people to say, oh, the other way of understanding concept is as a formal computational role, right? And so the computational role here might be for like the food that Alice loves. It's like, in principle, that concept is a function. It's a function that maps from any food to how much Alice loves it. That makes sense? And so there's some abstract mathematical formalism of that concept somewhere. And then you can kind of, once you've written it down as like a mathematical object, you can ask, oh, can that mathematical object, can that be stuck in this vector space? Can it live in here somehow, right? And if we have a space of, oh, the food that Alice loves, the food that Bob loves, the food that Carl loves, all these different foods that people love, right? You've got this whole space of different foods that people love. Can they all be like, you know, represented here, and how does it work, right? Now it's sort of more mathematical, and you can prove theorems about it, or you can set up a quantitative experiment or something like this, right? And you could express your data set this way. So this is, so like, okay, so yeah,
Now you can ask your question.
Oh, I guess I had a different one. I guess, what makes some concepts feel very just feel like you're like food. You're like you see it, you know it. I was having this a conversation with a friend. He was like, if I'm a shareholder in McDonald's, am I complicit in the obesity crisis? And we're like arguing over the word complicit. Like that feels like a very leaky abstraction. But it was like you said pretty with great confidence that you were a shareholder. Like that seems to be like a pretty firm one. Is there a frame here that helps explain that discrepancy?
So, what the difference between the real meaning of something and just saying something in a word? So my philosophy on this is after appearing inside these neural networks for a couple of years, is that they are all concepts at different levels, right? In other words, you can have purely linguistic concepts, or they just sort of say, well, somebody uttered complicit. It's just like the word they used. Who knows what that means? But then, deeper in the neural network, there may be other more abstract concepts that correspond to certain levels of taking responsibility or really having responsibility or perceiving responsibility or something like that. And then it's a very interesting question when you get away from just the literal words, whether the LLM or whether the AI is actually trying to parse apart these different abstract concepts that you might imagine they have to. So here's the basic dilemma. You could write down, so you could write a book on one of these concepts, what does real responsibility mean? What does real complicity mean? And stuff like this is what it would entail. And then once you really understand that deeply, you might be able to say, okay, well, there's different levels of taking responsibility. There's different agents and parties. It could be responsible for different objects and events and things and duties. And what understanding the levels of taking responsibility is you could say that a full accounting for that would be some mathematical object that would say, okay, your belief in taking some responsibility would be some kind of thing, some kind of information structure, right? Now, if you write down an information structure really abstractly like this, pretty quickly you get to an infinite dimensional thing, which is too big. It's even if you write it down as a mathematical object, right? This mathematical object is too big to fit in any computer. Certainly not a regular a neural network, right? And then the question is, well, my neural network doesn't seem to be fazed by that. This object is too big. It's reasoning about all these things anyway, right? So basically, one way of looking at this exercise that we're doing is we're asking, how do you jam this thing into that thing? Right? So you got some abstract representation of the concept that you want. Does this thing have it? There's a few ways you could jam something in. One way of jamming it would be round it off. You say, you know what? There's like 100, 1,000 million different ways of taking responsibility for something. I don't have room for all that. I just have one way in my model. And that'd be a way of saving bits. Right, or there might be some way of decomposing it. So I think that this gap is the thing that historically people were struggling with, and all this old classical work on connectionism. And I think this gap will permanently be with us as we work with LLMs and we understand their capabilities and limitations. And so this is part of, what we're after by keeping this field going, is understanding this gap. Okay. So, all right. Let's see who else had a question. There's another Kai. Kai had a question that I thought was appropriate to talk about at this point. Is Kai around?
Yes. I was going on kind of a tangent
Yes.
because the why concepts are probably vectors paper
Yes.
talked mainly about concepts in word vectors, and they
Yes.
talked about the relationship between those, like
Yes.
dog is to dogs, is cat is to cats,
Yes.
that kind of thing.
Yes.
And there's other work showing that models also kind of have those relationships. Like you train a model on summarization and like news, and a model on classification and news, then the difference between those two models is like analogous to that difference in other domains too.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And so kind of a broader question that I had was like if we treat models as like billion dimensional vectors, are they
Yes, please.
representing things like domains or tasks? Like what level of knowledge can we represent with vectors?
Yes. Yes. So you're asking a couple of meta questions, and so you sort of skipped over to this thing here. You said there's other, so there are some really simple abstractions. Like, is there a dog in the room? It's a true or false, like, concept, right? And a lot of, like, the literature is dealing with, like, oh, if you have a whole bunch of true and false concepts, then how do you represent them, and so on. We'll come back to that. But then you're like, oh, but there are complex concepts, like models of things and relationships between things and so on. So you're sort of down here. And so I think this is where, the way to think of it is to say, yes, there are a lot of really, really interesting, like, meta concepts. In fact, like a whole neural network, a whole model, a whole agent, you can kind of think of as one of these things. And then you can ask, oh, does that situate inside a neural network somehow? Is it struggling to try to represent this and understand it and how or not? Now, in a neural network, there's a couple levels of abstraction, a couple levels of reasoning, and some of these are part of the debate in this discourse. So I think that there's this really interesting distinction between, like, long-term memory and short-term context or short-term memory. And most of what we are playing with in this class has to do with what can you represent in the activations, in the short-term memory, in, like, the neural states, right? But most of what the rest of machine learning is working on is how do you get things loaded into long-term memory? How do you adjust the parameters of a neural network so that those parameters serve as an imprint of all the long-term knowledge that you want that neural network to remember when you boot it up and you wake it up and it has no context, right? Like, what does it already know? It already knows that Einstein was a brilliant physicist. It already knows that Madame Curie, discovered radiation or whatever. It already knows all these things. You didn't have to tell it, right? And so, but so there's these two different things, and traditionally they're sort of separated. But one of the interesting things is, oh, can you kind of simulate one in the other, right? Like, in the short-term knowledge, can you, do things that behave as if you're learning something in the long-term style and so on, right? So there's this whole world of, like, can you take a traditional learning algorithm down here and then also jam it up here and things like that? Because I think in your question you asked something about, models.
I have a question about just, in interpretability as a field right now, like, we look a lot at, like, single token, concept that are important in, like, single token. So when you're talking about this sort of functional view of, representing, like, complex concepts, like, do you feel like the answer to, say, like, multi-token representations or long form, like, a concept that's diffused over, like, a long set of tokens, like, do you think the answer to that also lies in finding a function that somehow
So I
maps?
think that there's definitely things where, like, Nikhil is looking at some of the binding questions, and the structures that he's finding definitely span many tokens. Now, he's probing into these things because of the tools that we have, looking at things one token at a time. But when after he looks one token at a time, he sees these structures and these look backs and things that go back many tokens. And so I think that, yes, ultimately the strategies that the networks probably use when they're representing complex things are exploiting the long sequence rollouts. But how that structure all works, I think, is still very obscure to us, and we're just, like, scratching the surface. And so it's just a little view of like, the problems that need to be solved, not really a view of, like, oh, somehow we know what things are. That make sense? Okay. Does that answer your question? Everyone? Okay,
I
cool.
know, yeah.
Okay, kind of. Okay, so some quiz. Okay, so oh, did I get everybody? Wait, did I get everybody? I got everybody, right? Kai? Kai? We talked about Kai's questions a little bit. Okay. So, okay, quiz. So there's these three different views, and even within the kind of the connectionist view, right, there's sort of three different ways that you could think of a bag of neurons. And so I'll introduce sort of three, I'll make up three names for these communities. They probably don't like to be called this way. So let's say we had this problem of knowing what animals are in the room, right? Any animals in the room? No animals in the room. Oh, just a whole bunch of humans. That's great. So, but like, let's say there were some like zoo animals that might be in the room. Like, oh, is there a giraffe in the room? Like, how big is the giraffe? How's, you know, is there a dog in the room? And so the question is, like, if we had five neurons in our brain, then how many different animals could we represent? Oh, I already clicked forward one. Okay, so here's a hint. So if you were a localist, then you would say every neuron is a concept. Who's heard of the idea of a grandmother neuron? Right? So this is just an old joke that came from Professor Leffen from 50 years ago. He was teaching people about neural networks. He says, imagine that you might have a neuron that represents every concept. Think about all the thoughts that you can have. You clearly have a concept in your head for your grandmother, who makes you apple pie every time you go home for Christmas and wears a nice red dress that you remember, right? And so what if you had a neuron for that concept? What if it had a physical manifestation of this neuron? Then you would have this concept of your grandmother. Isn't that interesting? So every time you thought about your grandmother, it would light up. Every time you weren't thinking about your grandmother, it would be quiet. That's kind of cool. And so that would be the model for the localist view of animals. You might have one for a cat, one for a dog, one for the giraffe, one for the lion, one for whatever, right? But if we only had five neurons, then we could represent five animals, and that's it. But we could do it in any combination, which would be nice. That makes sense? So now, there's this other view of what you would do with five neurons.
Sorry, I had another question.
Yes.
Like, so, you know, like the monosemantic view of, well, if you had like as many neurons as the number of features you're trying to represent, like, they all, like, each neuron would represent a feature.
Yeah,
is that like
that.
Verified? Like, in the sense that if you had five neurons and five concepts, like, does polysemanticity, or like, does it still emerge? Like, is there still some sparsity with the model?
If the world that you live in only has five animals,
yeah,
and the brain that you have to use has five neurons, then the toy experiments that were done actually in Nahaj suggest that you don't get polysemanticity. It says, oh, look, we have the perfect number of neurons for the perfect number of concepts that we have in our data. I have one neuron per concept. Done. And you get this. So this actually shows up empirically. We'll talk about that in a minute. Right. Okay, but now, you're clever computer scientists. How many things can you distinguish if you have five bits?
Five factorial?
I don't know. That's a little bit like. What were you saying?
Two to the five.
Yeah, this is more traditional computer science. Right, so five bits is, five bits, not five quarter bits. Yeah. Neurons can be on, they can be off. That's what we'll think about. They don't get shuffled. Right, make sense? And so like in a combinatorial encoding, which I have here, there's like, if you count very carefully, I got Gemini to draw me 32 little red dots there, right? So it's a hypercube, projecting into 3D space with 32 corners, right? So I don't know if you know why I'm saying it's a hypercube, but basically, yes. So basically, there's this combinatorial view, which is we could represent 32 things. So what if you had like 20 neurons? Then how many things could you represent with this combinatorial view? Well, you could, with the localist view, you could like represent 20 animals. But with the combinatorial view, what is 2 to the 20? Any computer scientists, quick with 2 to the 20? What was 2 to the 10?
I think 2 to 20 is like about a million.
About a million, yes, because 2 to the 10 is about 1,000. Did you notice? Okay, right, so, and 2 to the 20 is about a million. And so, yeah, it explodes very quickly. So you could like distinguish between like a million different situations if you had 20 neurons. Just 20 neurons, 20 neurons, not that many. A lot of situations to distinguish, but then it's very limited, because if we had our catalog, our zoo of a million animals, and every neural configuration was like one of the animals, then if some other animal walked in, it would have a very different configuration, and then I'd have trouble with compositionality. Like, well, not both animals are in the room. Like, I don't know what state to put my system in. Now, in the localist thing, no problem. I can just light up both of those neurons. I can have both. That makes sense? But in this combinatorial view, it's very fragile. I can't even have two animals in the same room. right? Like if I added those two bit strings together, then what would happen is I would like hallucinate some third animal, right? You see how that would work? That makes sense because I get some other bit pattern. Yeah, and so El-Hajj actually argues this is where a lot of hallucinations come from. A lot of, right, it's from like these kind of things. Okay, so there's this geometric encoding, which is the third thing, which is like, oh, don't think of every neuron as a separate thing. Think of it as like a vector. And Piantedosi says it's a vector. Well, I don't know, what is that bias? I don't know if bias is anything. Right? Like how many independent things can you represent if you have a five-dimensional vector? Anybody remember the linear algebra? Like how many independent things can you represent in like a five-dimensional vector space? Five. It's no better than the other thing. Right? So like what's the big deal about vectors? I could just stick with neurons. And that's how I started my PhD. I was like, well, that's gonna look at what the neurons are doing. Right? And in some domains that works pretty well. But the vectors have an advantage because what happens is this limitation that you can only represent five independent things in a vector space is only true if you constrain your vectors to all be linearly independent. Or like if, you know, or even orthogonal to each other, but you know, like if linearly independent from each other. If you actually relax that a bit and allow them to be usually orthogonal to each other, usually almost orthogonal, usually independent from each other if you sample a subset of them. But if you took all of them, then they're not independent anymore. But if you took any random subset, then they're usually independent, right? So if you relax that a bit, then you can get these like good enough almost bases that have more than five things. You could very reasonably represent like 20 things in it. And so what I've shown here is like a beach ball kind of thing, like a Voronoi diagram of like, you know, how different regions of belief might be organized. It's not, things are not orthogonal to each other, but instead you get things where you have similar beliefs because you're sort of nearby. Okay, so talk more about this here in detail for a second. So, I had that great figure and I didn't paste it in. I was like, I worked on this figure for like an hour and I didn't paste it in my slide. Oh, where is it? Where is it? Let me find it here. Oh, it's too late. I can put it on the whiteboard. Okay, so I'm going to review like El-Hajj's experiment here. Right. So this is a magic. So sad. Oh, I worked on this nice figure. Okay, I can put it on the whiteboard. So El-Hajj did this. He says, what if we just have five neurons and how many animals can we do? He doesn't talk about animals. Like very abstract. He's like X sub I with importance 0.7 to the I and with sparsity 0.3. Right. So what is this? So what he's saying is, let's say we have like 20 animals in the zoo that might come into our classroom, right? And I have to build a little neural network to remember, to sense and remember and represent like which animals I have here. And not only that, but like how big they are or something, some real number about each animal, right? So I have to remember a random size of 20 animals, right? But I only have five neurons to use. Some animals are more important. I'll tell you, if the lion is here, I don't want to forget that. Super important, right? But like if I forget the squirrel, that's okay. Like less important. Make sense? And so I have different levels of importance of every animals. And then the nice thing is that with some probability S, like any given animal will be absent. Like I could set S to like 50%. And that means that, oh, actually 50-50, like any given animal is just not here. Animal's just, you know, the line's not here. So it's sparse. That makes sense. So this is like the data situation that we're facing. And so we have 20 different animals and only five neurons to deal with it. What happens? And so yeah, the diagram that I was gonna draw was this like autoencoder type of diagram where we have like these 20 inputs, right? And then we're gonna like make a little neural network to like assign a five-dimensional vector to every animal, right? Just a table. Every animal has a five-dimensional vector for our neurons. And then if multiple animals are in the same room, that we just apply the normal connectionist rule. Like, oh, two things are true at once, you just add them. Right? 10 things are true at once, you just add them all. And so you get some vector representation of like the set of animals. And then the reconstruction rule is the way that we read things out of neural networks is we do dot products. So we say, hey, we know what the vector is for elephant. And I've got some weird five-dimensional vector. I wonder if there's an elephant in the room, how big it is. And so I will, so to do that, I just take this five-dimensional vector, take the elephant vector and dot product it, and the dot product should recover the component of my five-dimensional thing, which is distributed by elephants. All right, so we read this back up. And then now, any linear algebra person will tell you, since five dimensions is a lot smaller than the 20, it's going to be lossy, there's going to be some error. So they just put this thing in an optimizer and they say, okay, well, you can come up with any dictionary you want, give any five-dimensional vector to any one of the 20 animals, just minimize your error, right? And then how do you minimize it? You just step into an optimizer for 5 minutes. And they say, come up with a nice dictionary for all of the five-dimensional vectors for every animal. They minimize this error, weighted by this importance. Like, we don't want to forget about the lion, but yeah, it's compromising on the squirrels, okay. Make sense? So that's what the situation is, and then sorry if you're not having the diagram. And so this is what they found, right? Which was that if you do this with a regular linear network, or if you do this with sparsity zero, in other words, every animal is always there, the whole zoo is always here, right? But sometimes, like, the lion is really big, sometimes the lion's really small, right? Sometimes the squirrel's big, sometimes the squirrel's small, right? But the zoo is always here. Or if the model is perfectly linear, then you get this picture. This picture is equivalent to PCA. Who's ever used PCA in their research? Or SVD, yeah. So this is saying what the brain learns is that it's got five dimensions available, and it's going to allocate those five dimensions to the five most important animals. It needs to keep track of all the carnivores, and none of the other animals matter. Right? It's going to allocate zero resources to any of the other animals because the carnivores are always in the room. It needs to know how big they are. Right? And all the other animals are in the room too, but they don't matter. So that's what the network does. But as soon as you introduce nonlinearity in the network, so you make it a neural network, so you have a relative, it's not a big deal, it's technicality, so you can do nonlinear functions, and then you add sparsity to the system. You say, oh, what do they say for sparsity? Can I read this off? Sparsity 0.3. So with 30% chance, any given animal's not here, right? So maybe the carnivores aren't here, like a 30% chance that the lion's not here, a 30% chance the cheetah's not here, right? Then what it will do is it'll start to say, I only have five dimensions, but I can come up with a code book that has codes for seven animals.
Is that 70% chance? That's fine.
Oh, maybe you're right. 70% chance. No, you're right. So because it's 1 minus s. Thanks. Gotta get the numbers right.
Yes.
Yeah. 70% chance. So I guess it has to be pretty sparse for this to show up. If it's only 30% chance, you probably don't see this. Probably sticks here for a lot of time. But it needs to be like it has to get pretty rare for an animal to be around. And so if 70% chance the animals aren't around, then it starts saying, oh, you know what? I'll write down codes for seven animals instead of five. And now what is going on with these yellow things is that they're not linearly independent of each other. They're these other vectors that can be confused with one another, right? So like Like if we have a few of these animals come in, then it's like, do I have a really big squirrel and a medium-sized ostrich and a bat? Or is that what I get from a giant toad and some other thing? Because those two situations would give me the same vector. Like, I don't know, I can't tell. Which way, like, it's ambiguous. It's truly ambiguous. But when you do the readout, it says, oh, if you just do a dot product, I'll give you an estimate of like how big the toad was and how big the ostrich was. And you get these numbers. And those numbers are close. They're as close as possible. They actually optimize the loss compared to like throwing away the data. That makes sense? And so that's the solution. So you see this like slightly larger code book, and as sparsity increases, so now 97% chance, you know, the animal's not here, right? You know, 99% chance the animal's not here. You get a fully sparse code book, right? If it's rare for any of the carnivores to ever show up, then don't give them the whole dimension. They don't get their whole own neuron, right? They only get the whole own neuron if they're like pretty frequently there. Right, but if 99% of the time they're not there, they don't get a neuron. They just get something in an overlapping code book. Right, that makes sense. Yeah, so that's the superposition story, and this is something that neural networks can do that the bi-neuron localist one neuron at a time thing cannot do. It can pack more concepts in, right, but with some error. With some loss, with some ambiguity, but inevitably, because right? it's going beyond what linear algebra says you can do unambiguously. Now, do you guys understand the Hodge experiment, Courtney?
Yeah. Hi. My question was about how stable superposition is across different models, and like, are they consistently grouping the same features together or assigning the same sparsity?
Yeah.
And if they are so different, then how do we know that the superposition examples we see are actually reliable?
Right. And Avery, you had a similar question, is that right? Is Avery here?
Yeah. Yeah, I asked that.
Exactly the same question. Exactly the same question. Okay, another project. So the answer is the jury's out. When people try to do this, on purpose, like, you know, so there's all these people like training at the AEs, which are the form of doing this on purpose, like trying to find discover sparse codes. One of the big problems is SAEs are not stable. Every time you like go and train them again, they like divide up the space very differently. On the other hand, it says that for really important concepts that have relationships to each other, they tend to learn the same structure, right? I also think that the research so far has been relatively oversimplified. Like this toy model story and SAEs themselves, they have this assumption of independence between all the features. If your features are all independent, then there isn't any particular reason for some of them to group together or not. But in real data, you have a lot of groupings, a lot of correlations and a lot of relationships. And so it may be that in real data, you tend to get more reproducibility and superposition, but it hasn't been studied very well. And so it's an open source research. Anybody wants to do that for their PhD? Another question from UT?
Oh yeah, hi. I'm curious about what SAE used for. Like, in my eyes, it's just like a map from a low dimensional to a higher dimensional.
Yeah. That's yep. Right. What's this buff? So in this thing, if I remember to draw the diagram, you can see this toy example is a map from high dimension to low dimension. So you have like 20 concepts that deal with it. And what the SAEs are claiming or attempting to do is like you have this five-dimensional thing. Can we guess what the true underlying 20 features were that were compressed into this thing? So SAEs are an attempt at doing an unsupervised decompression technique to reverse what they hypothesize as this kind of process. And if you feed this kind of process in a toy process, the SAEs are pretty good at decompressing it. But of course, they apply SAEs to real data, to try to decompress it. And I'm actually kind of skeptical. Like they have all sorts of issues like with instability and things like this. I'm not sure they're really getting a good decompression of all the concepts. They're probably finding a few, right? But that's what they're trying. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then, so that's sort of how SAEs fit into it. But a lot of people work on SAEs and they're getting better over time. So Luzi had this question about safety. How do you say your name?
You should be online.
Oh, Luzi, are you online? Yeah, I'll ask Luzi's question. Luzi? Yeah, sorry. So what does this mean for safety? Like if these things are like so approximate, like how can we ever assure any of the behavior ever? And I think the answer is, well, for the traditional mathematical sense of like the symbolic reasoning, people would say, you know, we're going to make a proof that this thing is never going to misbehave or something like that. I think that it's pretty dire for that. I don't think you're ever going to get a proof out of a system that uses more dimensions than you have capacity, or you're going to get aliasing and problems like this. You're going to get like hallucinations are just inherent. And so the old-fashioned type of safety, right? I don't think it's that. I'm not optimistic, right? After this kind of analysis. I could be wrong. Like there are definitely people. There's a whole community of people out there making assurances around provable guarantees on neural networks, doing really impressive work, getting like propagation of bounds and provable guarantees through like GPU hardware, trying to scale this up for larger neural networks. But I think that even if you can figure out what the error bounds are and everything, like you're still stuck with this situation that in order for the networks to perform well, they end up playing tricks like this, which end up giving you aliasing, which I don't think is about some error bound. I think it's just how they work. So, on the other hand, there's other ways of achieving safety, like measuring them, and also recognizing what they're representing and understanding whether that actually aligns with what you're trying to do. So, the previous paper story where I'm like, hey, you come up with this thing and you see how it jams into that, and does it fit, does it not, what's like thrown overboard? I think that if we understand this, if we understand what compromises the network is making and like how it's representing things, then that's sort of the path to safety, right? So then at least we understand like what the network is trying to do, what it's not trying to do, what it's good at, what it's bad at because of like what compromises it's making. And so I think that's sort of the path. But in terms of like, oh, can we guarantee that the network will never utter a thing? I'm not really sure. Make sense? And then, okay, question about Claire Sparsity. Is Claire here? Yes.
I think my question is related to like sparse neural networks and Komovo.
Yes. And KNs and stuff like this. So KNs I'll set aside for a little bit just because so KNs are a different way of doing neural networks. Instead of having weights between things, you can learn functions between layers. There's an old system called generalized additive models, which KNs generalize by stacking them layer to layer. So I think the reality of KNs, and so some people disagree with me, is that they're a theoretical construct. The people who published a big KN paper a couple years ago said they're going to outperform neural networks. And, people started showing up with like venture capital money and saying, oh, yeah, you're going to beat all the neural networks. Here you go. I think in reality, nobody uses them because they're computationally really efficient. They're hard to train. They're hard to run. So they're not that practical. It's a nice conceptual idea. So I'm going to set KNs aside, because it's a little bit of a niche idea. For the sparsity, the thing I want to make a point about is that this situation doesn't come up because your neural network is sparse. This situation is coming up because the world is sparse, because the lion is not always in the room. 97% of the time, the lion is not here. So most of the time, you could ignore the fact that there might be a lion. And like it would be wasteful to like allocate a whole neuron to a lion because 99% of the time, it's like that neuron's like would be zero. It'd be off. It's like, what a waste. So instead, the neural network learns to have like a more efficient encoding, but it becomes sort of inherently ambiguous. But But this thing comes from sparsity in the world, not sparsity in the neural network. Right, so that's a sort of a distinction that I wanted to clarify. Okay, so dot products. So what this geometric view is all around, concentric vector. So what does it mean when we say concentric vector? Right, like it's just a vector is just a sequence of numbers. Like how's that different from just saying concept is like a message? It could be like written in ASCII and then is ASCII vector and so on. So what you normally don't do with an ASCII vector or any sequence of numbers you see somewhere in text is you normally don't take dot products of them, right? And so when Piantedosi says, oh, concepts are vectors, and you're talking about connectionist literature and everything, this is the heart of it. Like, how do you know if a sequence of numbers you have is a vector? It's as soon as somebody starts doing dot products between vectors, then you're like, ah, that's a vector. You're in a vector space. There's some dimensionality. There's some geometry here. And there's three ways of thinking about dot products. One is, it's just a way of telling you how well two vectors match. So there's this old trick people would do with punch cards, is they'd say, hey, are these punch cards similar? And you could line up the two punch cards and you could see how many holes they have in common. That's a dot product between punch cards. It tells you how similar, the more light shines through, the more similar they are. That's literally what a dot product is. So I like this kind of picture. Right, so dot products are just like the simplest possible thing you could do to look at similarity between two vectors, holding up two punch cards. But there's also this geometric view, which is it's angles between things, right? Everybody learned in middle school. And then there's also this Fourier view of you've got some really complicated thing and you're gonna decompose it into components, Fourier components or something like this. And there's another, view of what dot products are. And so all these views are all true. It's all the same math, right? They all exist at the same time. And this is what the basis for connection literature. So when we play with things, so a couple more come out when we present here. So more intuition building about vectors. So in middle school, we all learn about vectors in two dimensions. And when we got to high school, they're like, oh, there's a third dimension. Oh, three-dimensional vectors. Okay, so but in neural networks, price for entry is 1,000 dimensions. So now we're in 1,000 dimensional vector space. I'm sad to say 1,000 dimensional vector space works very differently from a three-dimensional vector space, even though all the math, sort of the same formulas, but just pumping up that number to 1,000. So if you take two random vectors in three dimensions, two random unit vectors, and you took a dot product between them, what would be a typical dot product between two random vectors in three dimensions? What do you think the mean is? Who wants to make a guess for what the mean dot product is between two vectors? Zero. No, it's higher. If you take two random vectors in three dimensions, so a dot product will tell you how close to parallel things are. So if you just took a vector in three space and another vector in three space, they're not going to be parallel, but they've got some closeness to parallel. And so I need to figure out the cosine of the angle. So what's the average cosine of the angle between these two vectors? What would you say? Well, if it were perfectly parallel, the cosine would be 1. So it's definitely going to be less than 1. And they're perfectly orthogonal, it's going to be 0. Well, that seems rare also, so it's going to be more than 0. So in three dimensions, what do you think the average cosine is? Something between 0 and 1. Yeah, just throw out a number. 0.5, good guess. 0.46, very good. Okay, so it's about half. Right now, we're in 1,000 dimensions, we do the same thing. We just pick two random vectors, and you get a dot product. What's the average? Say again, louder, louder, what's that? Closer to 0? How close to 0? 0? Yes. 0, exactly 0?
Yes.
No. It's never exactly 0. You never get there's some curve, but it's closer to 0. So I'll tell you how close. 0.025. So it's pretty close to 0. Right. So in three dimensions, that would be indistinguishable from being at a right angle. So that's why in 1,000 dimensions, you take random vectors. The assumption is, it would be if they were not at right angles, it would be weird. It's wow. This dot product between these two things is 0.1. That's 5 times bigger than the dot product should be. That's a high dot product. Oh no, not 5 times, like that. That's 50 times higher, right? Or whatever. It just like you can see. And so okay, then if you have like volume in high dimensions, so if you have a ball, it has what? IR cubed, whatever, you know, that volume, right? If you shrink the ball by 1% radius, now you have another ball inside. How much did you shrink the volume of the ball? In 3 dimensions. Now the new ball has a new volume. So the old ball had volume 1, and so the new ball has volume, let's say the new volume proportional to the old ball, shrinking it by 1%, bringing it to 99%. Yeah.
Oh, 0.97.
0.97. Yes, physics percent. Exactly. Linear approximation of cubing a number, 97. All right, that makes sense? So like the volume, like the linear dimension goes down by 1. That means that the volume goes down by 3 because you're in 3 dimensions, which should give you a hint. What happens if you're in 1,000 dimensions? So you just shrink the ball by 1%. What happens to the volume? Am I out of time? I'm out of time. What happened to our lab? I said, I'm going to go through this fast. I'm going to only have 6 slides. And I like use an hour for 6 slides. Sorry. I don't know how to go through this fast. It's too much material. You want to do it, Thursday?
Sure. I don't know if I'll be able to question on Thursday because I have a...
Okay, but you guys have to do this for homework anyway. So there's a notebook. Will you guys try it tonight and log into the Discord and share if you have any trouble? And then if and then Karuna can also fix it for you. Can you do that? It's actually supposed to be helpful for your homework for Thursday, right? Your Tuesday. Does that make sense? I'm gonna just share you the rest of these numbers here. So the volume drops to 0.004%. How much of the cube is filled by a unit sphere in 3 dimensions is 52%. In 1,000 dimensions, it's this crazy astronomical number, 10^-2700, right? But basically a cube, a hypercube in 1,000 dimensions is all corner. It's no interior, like basically all corner. If you have a normal distribution, right, so you take a normal vector, people are like, hey, take a Gaussian distribution. It's like a ball. I know what that's like. It's like fuzzy, right? So actually, in 3 dimensions, like it's pretty rare to have like a Gaussian normal distribution, even though it's like the mode. It's pretty rare for it to have zero length, even though it's like the most probable vector, right? But the length is, you know, around 1.6, right, with this kind of distribution. When you get to 1,000 dimensions, this is the length of a Gaussian vector. It's 31.6, and the length is limited. Anything? Almost zero. Okay, I'm out. Okay, you go. You go. Oh no! I have so many things to talk about. Oh, what did you do? Okay. Yes.
I don't know.
Yes. I'll put them online.
Thank you very much.
Hey guys. Okay.